Hello there. Today is Tuesday, June 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, another appeals court rules against the president's travel ban, but for a different reason.
A number of really significant hurdles they have to overcome.
The U.S. role on the world stage, we talked to a former ambassador. Remembering the victims of the Orlando Pulse nightclub massacre 1 year later.
It's really just opened my eyes, showing me that we need to love everyone.
Also ahead, gadget lovers are in heaven as the Electronic Entertainment Expo gets underway. It's all on today's International Edition. Another U.S. appeals court voted unanimously on Monday to uphold a block on President Trump's revised travel ban Monday, saying the administration violated federal immigration law and failed to provide a valid reason for keeping people from six mostly Muslim nations from coming to the country. Attorney General Jeff Sessions insisted the new decision would harm national security, an argument the judges rejected. White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer was asked about it during Monday's briefing.
I think we can all attest that these are very dangerous times, and we need every available tool at our disposal to prevent terrorists from entering the United States and committing acts of bloodshed and violence. We continue to be confident that the president's executive order to protect this country is fully lawful and ultimately will be upheld by the Supreme Court.
Well, joining me now for more on what the ruling means is attorney Anna Rose Matheson with the California Appellate Law Group, which often litigates before the Ninth Circuit. So tell us exactly what happened here with this ruling.
The Ninth Circuit handed the Trump administration another loss, and a loss on different grounds than the other court had previously ruled, which will make it even harder for the Trump administration to win in the Supreme Court.
Why is that? What were the different grounds?
The lower court, the trial court in this case, and the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, the other appellate court to reach it, both ruled on First Amendment grounds. That is, they said this ban was effectively establishing religion or giving religious preferences, and therefore it was unconstitutional. The Ninth Circuit ruled on statutory grounds. That is, it said Congress has complete control over immigration. That's in the Constitution. Congress gets to call the shots when it comes to immigration. Congress has given the president some power over immigration, but the Ninth Circuit case said the president's ban here does not fit within the power that Congress has given to the president. If it doesn't fit, that means it's improper as a matter of statute, because the president has no power to make immigration decisions unless Congress has given it to him.
Where did Trump's tweets fit into all of this? Did that play a role in the court's decision?
It did, less so in this opinion, in the Ninth Circuit opinion, than in the other decisions. In the prior Ninth Circuit opinion and in the Fourth Circuit opinion, Trump's tweets really targeting Muslims and focusing on how this is a ban and we want to keep these people out really were used by the court to show that this ban is essentially dripping with religious animosity. In this case, by contrast, they are used to kind of show that there really wasn't a careful, considered justification. That is, that the Trump administration didn't provide a rationale explaining why barring people from these countries would be detrimental to the interests of the United States.
What now? The White House says they will prevail. Where does it go from here?
Well, there's only one place for it to go, and that's the Supreme Court. And that process has already started. The Trump administration filed a request for it to be heard by the Supreme Court and to do it on an expedited basis on a much quicker schedule than they usually would. And they will likely ask for this case to be heard as well. They have to essentially prevail on overturning both the decision of the Fourth Circuit and of the Ninth Circuit. They have to convince the Supreme Court that there is neither a statutory nor a constitutional problem with this ban in order to be able to get the ban put in place. There's another wrinkle, and that is this case might very well be what lawyers call moot. That is, there's no actual controversy anymore because the Trump travel ban will expire under its own terms on Wednesday. And there's no way the Supreme Court's going to rule before then. So the second ban that the administration issued, remember the first ban they issued in January was withdrawn. So the second ban that's being considered now, under the terms of the order issued by the Trump administration, was only supposed to last for 90 days. And those 90 days will be up on Wednesday. So by the time the U.S. Supreme Court agrees to hear it, the order, even if they reversed, wouldn't be in effect anymore. Or at least that's what those attacking the ban say. The administration says, well, no, you should really look at the lower court opinions putting in an injunction as stalling it and postponing it so it would go into effect for 90 days from whenever that injunction was lifted. But there's a really serious question now about whether this ban still has any viability, even if the court was to consider it. And that's a number of really significant hurdles they have to overcome.
All right. That's attorney Anna Rose Matheson with the California Appellate Law Group. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Indian Prime Minister Modi to meet with Trump in Washington. The Russian court sentences the opposition leader to 30 days in jail. Sessions' testimony to Congress Tuesday will be open to the public. And the UN resettles albino refugees due to threats in Malawi. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Donald Trump's policy moves, be it the Paris Climate Agreement or his earlier departure from the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Pact, have raised questions about the road ahead, both in Europe and Asia. Some wonder if Trump's America First policy moves are a sign Washington is abdicating its global leadership role. Others have noted the space it has created for China to assert its expanding economic and diplomatic clout. In remarks underscoring strains between Washington and its closest allies, Canada's foreign minister recently said it will seek to play a larger role on the world stage as the U.S. retreats. Also, German Chancellor Angela Merkel recently expressed doubts about the reliability of the United States. Well, joining me now to discuss is former U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan and current CEO of the East-West Institute, Cameron Munzer. Thank you so much for being with us, sir. So what is your take on the recent comments that we've heard from leaders like Angela Merkel?
There are two ways to look at this. One way is we can't rely on the United States implies we can't trust the United States. That's a very negative and very harsh way of looking at this. And you can probably imagine that there is widespread distress in Europe and indeed around the world about the decision to pull out of the climate agreement and other decisions of that sort. There's another interpretation of what she said that I think is a little less apocalyptic. And it's that agreement with certain elements of what many Americans have said, which is that Europe does have to pull its weight in defense. Europe does have to strike out on its own. It can't just be an economic superpower and not be a military and political or security superpower as well. And so if you choose to look at it down that second track, there was an article I read by a German analyst who said, you don't have to be great friends to still get along sufficiently and for Europe to do more for itself. So that's not so negative, that idea of Europe being self-sufficient, and especially a Europe that is a Europe led by Merkel and Macron that wants to fix the things or at least confront the things that everyone knows are weaknesses in the way the EU is run. But back to the original way, if you say, oh my God, we can't rely on, in a sense, we can't agree on and we can't find common cause with the Americans, that is sad. And that does manifest itself in differing notions about climate change and some other broader things, perhaps attitudes towards trade, that are pretty concerning to a lot of people who believe in international cooperation.
Speaking of international cooperation, President Trump is withdrawing from the Paris Accord. How do you view this?
There is a school of thought that says that the position of the U.S. government, if you look at who has been selected as the EPA leader and some other statements by people in the government, the position of the government has been to make a U-turn on the attitude of the previous administration. So that one of the things about being out of the Paris Agreement is that it's a clean break, that had we stayed in the climate agreement but not worked hard to do the things to make it work, somehow that would also have been bad. There is a certain honesty of having the government say what it's going to do rather than the government be in the climate accord and decide it's going to undermine it by the specific policies it pursues. That said, it's a huge symbolic blow that the world's biggest country, which has been a leader in this area, is now the outlier. It's a symbolic blow to the idea of solidarity and a symbolic blow to the image of the United States as a leader. Many business leaders have been critical of the president's decision, saying it's not just a question of the morality or the common sense of fighting this, but it is actually, they would interpret it as a bad economic decision, because what it will do is imply that the United States is not going to be on the forefront of modern technologies that are clean.
Do you, as a diplomat, as someone who has spent a lot of time overseas, can the U.S. continue to be the leader of the free world? Can the U.S. continue to be a leader with this America First, go it alone strategy?
It's an interesting problem because, you know, you have people like McMaster and others saying America First doesn't mean America alone, and that really is going to be the decision. If it does become America alone, then your answer is pretty clear. Yeah, America can't lead in the way that we understood it. The way that we understood it in the past when I worked there, one of our strengths was the belief that we could leverage American power in as much as people voluntarily wanted to work with us on issues of common interest, that made American power greater. It made us not only stronger because people looked up to us, but it was just more effective way of getting things done if you had everyone going in the same direction. If you have a notion that different countries are going to compete and you can do better than other individuals and knock them off one by one, which is kind of America alone, there are certain ways in which you can get what I would think of as temporary advantage at various times. But it's hard to imagine in the way that we have seen the United States in the last 70 years. So we're faced, I think, with two roads ahead that could increasingly diverge over time. You know, NATO is not going away tomorrow, but if we tend more and more to go into bilateral relations with, say, Saudi Arabia or, say, China or other countries and ignore the way that multilateral institutions have worked, we will be leaving a world that we've used very much to our advantage, in my opinion, for the last 70 years. And that is something that I think honest former diplomats need to ask themselves. Are we upset about it because it's different, or are we upset? It's very different and very unusual and hard for traditional thinkers, and I put myself in that position, hard for us to imagine how this helps the United States. Right now, take the example of just, you know, world leadership in the area of climate change. We are going to be ceding this to other countries. And if we also decide that we're not compelled by our agreements to work in areas like solar power or wind power or other new technologies, we're going to miss out, or could find ourselves missing out on being on the cutting edge, as we have been in the past, of new technologies. So I think it is a very dangerous road to go down, leave the advantages voluntarily somehow that America has had as the leader of the free world.
All right. U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan and current CEO of the East-West Institute, Cameron Munter, thank you for being with us. Turning now to what's trending on social media, we are joined by VOA's Andrew Palchevsky. Hey, Andrew, what's happening?
So there's a thing called the Presidential Records Act, and mm-hmm. it requires presidents not to delete anything that they have as far as documents or emails. It's part of the reason why presidents, ever since the advent of emails, haven't used it very much, because all those emails have to be preserved and stored and looked at. However, we have a president now who is tweeting quite a lot and using Twitter quite a lot. So there's a Congressman, Mike Quigley, who would like to amend the Presidential Records Act to include tweets. And he named this bill that he has the Communications Over Various Feeds Electronically for Engagement Act.
Wow, that's a long one.
It is. But when you look at the first letter of each of those words, it spells out our favorite word, COFIFI.
So it's
COFIFI Act that he has enacted, proposed, and he is trying to get enacted, that will add Twitter and in social media to the Presidential Records Act, so that anything that President Trump tweets or messages will have to be preserved. So we'll see if this act goes anywhere. This is not the first time, by the way, that this Congressman Mike Quigley has done this. He previously had the Making Access Records Available to Lead American Government Openness Act, which is otherwise known as the Mar-a-Lago Act, Mar-a-Lago being the Florida resort that President Trump owns and spends a lot of time at. Okay. So having a little fun with these acts and titling them, but some serious issues there. Certainly with social media, it's one of those things right. that we're in a new world still. It's very recent. So it's not clear how social media records are going to get preserved, if they should be preserved. So we'll see if the COFIFI Act goes anywhere. But in the meantime, it's getting some headlines because of its title.
No doubt. No doubt. Anything else?
I don't know about you, but I have had this instance where I get frustrated by social media. You see all these great posts, people on vacation, people having a great time. Sometimes you just need to step away from social media. But what happens when you want to step away from social media and you still want to click and post and do all those kind of things? It's hard. It's almost like an addiction. You can't give it up. There's a gentleman named Dan Kurtz, and he invented an app called Binky. And it's a social media app where you can scroll through this feed and you can comment and you can like and you can swipe left and right and do all these things, except it is not a real social network. It is entirely fake. No one will ever see your comments or your likes or your clicks or anything like that. The reason why he invented this originally, he said it kind of did it as a joke, saying that people were so obsessed with social media, would they actually download an app that doesn't do anything? But people are actually downloading it now and saying it's kind of a way for them to get away from social media while still having the ability to click on things and post on social media. A bit of a, I guess, a training wheel or maybe a step process for people who are maybe addicted to social media or overusing it. A little bit like that fidget spinner that we're hearing a lot about, that fad that's sweeping across the U.S. and across the world with these little toys that you can click and spin and just keep your hands busy but not really doing anything. Kind of the social media version of a fidget spinner. So we'll see how this expands. It's right now on iOS for Apple devices. He said there might be an Android version going forward. We'll see if this empire expands to other useless apps.
I don't get it. If no one sees it and it doesn't, and it's not real, why bother?
You know, sometimes people, when they have their phone in their hand or their tablet, they just want to click on something.
Like a
game. Just
want to,
exactly. It's like a game. So people can just kind of scroll through. And it does have some fun, you know, posts in this endless scroll, different photos and things that you can look at. But if you get tired of looking at your friends' photos or you're not a social person and you want to feel social, then you can check out the Binky app. It might be right for you.
You need your Binky.
Yes. No mistake in the name there also. The Binky being a pacifier. A little bit of a social media pacifier for folks.
All right. Thanks so much, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Orlando city officials wanted the one-year anniversary of the shooting at Pulse nightclub to be marked with acts of kindness and love. June 12th has officially been named Orlando United Day, commemorating the horrific attack on the city's gay and lesbian community, where 49 people died. As Jeff Swicord reports, the city came out in a show of unity during weekend events to mark the tragedy.
They ran in remembrance. 1 year after the largest single attack on the gay and lesbian community in U.S. history killed 49, hundreds gathered in an Orlando park to run and remember the victims. Barbara Palma was the owner of Pulse nightclub where the shooting occurred.
What's different over the last year is everything. Everything is different. Everything you do every day is different. Your heart is forever changed. Your life is forever changed.
At 2 a.m., 29-year-old Omar Mateen entered Pulse nightclub with an assault rifle and began shooting, killing 49 people and wounding 53. Mateen, who had a history of mental instability, had pledged allegiance to the Islamic State. The horrific violence of that night deeply scarred all segments of Orlando society. 15-year-old Madeline Ward lived across the street from Pulse and has nightmares about what she saw and heard that night.
And it's really just opened my eyes, showing me that we need to love everyone, because it's not, this is like, we're a bunch of different groups of people and we might all be different, but we're all the same, and that we're human beings and we need to respect each other no matter who we love.
A year on, Orlando is a community that has come together. At a memorial featuring the Orlando Gay Chorus, a diverse group honored those lost. Dan Jones says the chorus is here to share a message of love and unity with all.
What the shooter was trying to do was destroy the LGBT community, and what he did was brought the LGBT community together, but also built bridges with other communities that we didn't have those bridges with before.
Those bridges have been on display at events during the past week. Last Saturday, Go Big Tees offered free T-shirts, food, and hugs in support of the LGBT community.
Thank you so much for coming.
Hundreds turned out for the food and to tie-dye their own T-shirts.
No, please come in.
Owner Hannah Zuck says the idea was to gather in love and support for all affected by the tragedy.
I think our community has grown together more, and it's been so beautiful to see the way everyone has unified and supported each other in the healing process.
Pulse nightclub has never reopened after the tragedy. Today it is a memorial to those who died, a place where people can stop by, leave a memento, and reflect.
It's a ring that was in a bag my sister bought for my birthday.
People like Mary Kelly and Taylor Caldwell.
We came here today because, at least for me, I'm really big in the LGBTQ community. And even if I wasn't, I think it would still come, just because something like this should never happen. And
they're right. Love conquers all.
It does. And I think the more people that we can draw here just shows that.
Yeah.
Jeff Swicord, VOA News, Orlando, Florida.
Well, the Electronic Entertainment Expo gets underway this week in Los Angeles. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, the convention brings together the top names in gaming with sequels to popular franchises expected to dominate the show.
More than 250 exhibitors and 2,500 products will be featured at the E3 show, which is taking over the Los Angeles Convention Center this week. One thing generating buzz at this year's show is Microsoft's new gaming console based on its Project Scorpio code. Microsoft says the Xbox One X console will be its most powerful ever, offering gamers better graphics, even if they don't have a 4K television. CNET's executive editor Ian Scher agrees.
We're going to even see that from Microsoft. They're going to have a new device, a new Xbox, that's just going to be bigger. It's going to be all these other things that it can do, and it's going to give us games that supposedly are even much better looking. And so it's going to be really interesting to see how far they can push this, right? At what point have they kind of finished making everything better and they just start building better games?
The console is expected to be released worldwide on November 7th and cost about $500 in the United States. Microsoft is hoping the Xbox One X will help it overtake Sony's PlayStation, which has outsold Microsoft's console since both were launched in 2013. Ian Scher says that Sony's studios have helped it design and produce games that give players more of what they're looking for.
You've got games like The Last of Us and all these other Uncharted and all these other games that are just really capture people's imaginations and really get them going. And Microsoft just doesn't have it in the same way. They have a few. Halo is a big game, but it's not enough, clearly. And so the big thing for them, Scorpio is going to definitely make it so that their technology is competitive. Great. The next step is games.
No sacrifice too great.
Welcome to the Bloody First. You're a long way from Texas, farm boy.
Fran Mirabella III is with IGN Entertainment, which focuses on games, films, entertainment, and technology. He says that fans and industry insiders can look for a lot of sequels at this year's E3.
Super Mario, Assassin's Creed, Call of Duty, because these things sell.
Gaming is still a business. It's not that gamers don't want something different, but like when you go see movies or anything else, you're hesitant to try something new. But you also crave what you know works well. And so there's some really good stuff that's working, and just it's the way games work, and you're never going to not see this happen.
However, Mirabella says that gamers can also look for some new offerings, like the pirate game Sea of Thieves. Last year, games, including mobile-based games, generated $91 billion in revenue. Gamers spent $6.6 billion on downloads to their consoles. PC gaming earned $34 billion. Some of those players might even get into this year's E3 show. It's usually an industry-only affair, but for the first time, the convention is offering about 15,000 tickets to dedicated gamers. The E3 show runs until June 15th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On June 6th, U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces and their Syrian Arab Coalition partners launched an all-out assault on the ISIS-occupied Syrian city of Raqqa. The importance of Raqqa cannot be overstated. ISIS captured the city in 2013, and a year later declared Raqqa to be its capital in Syria. The assault on the city begins just as Iraqi forces, with support from the U.S.-led Anti-ISIS Combined Joint Task Force, make the final push of a six-month-long campaign to clear the last ISIS forces out of Mosul, the group's Iraqi capital. The loss of either city would be a hard blow to the terrorists. Now they are faced with the probability of losing both. Indeed, the Syrian Democratic Forces and the U.S.-led Anti-ISIS Combined Joint Task Force have been preparing the ground for the assault on Raqqa for many months, ensuring the best possible conditions for the attacking forces. With the support of countless bombing raids by the Joint Task Force, the Syrian Democratic Forces and Syrian Arab Coalition have seized control of the terrain north of the Euphrates River and the strategically important town of Dabqa. In the meantime, in anticipation of the attack on Raqqa, the Anti-ISIS Combined Joint Task Force has been conducting air raids on ISIS targets within and around the town. On the day before the assault began, 24 airstrikes hit over a dozen groups of fighters, destroying equipment, booby traps such as houses rigged with explosives, and a weapons storage facility. The fight for Raqqa will be long and difficult, and it will not be the last. But the offensive will deliver a decisive blow to the idea of ISIS as a physical caliphate, said commander of the U.S.-led coalition battling ISIS, General Steve Townsend. The international coalition and our partner forces are steadily dismantling the physical caliphate of ISIS. Once ISIS is defeated in both Mosul and Raqqa, there will still be a lot of hard fighting ahead. But this coalition is strong and committed to the complete annihilation of ISIS in both Iraq and Syria.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.